so I'm here with my old friend, Fabrice Midal. He's the founder of the École Occidentale de la Méditation, which is a meditation school in Paris, a very big meditation school, which is really, I think, quite an original and revolutionary kind of school, and different than a lot of other schools of this sort. And Fabrice is also an author of many, many books, including The French Art of Not Giving a Fuck, which I haven't read yet, but I've read many, many of your books, and I've been following your work over the years. And I wanted to talk to you because I want to introduce you to some of my friends in the English world, because I think what you do is very important. So maybe I could you just start by like introducing yourself a little bit, say what your school is about, what your mission is about, and what is this French art of not giving a fuck?
So maybe I discovered meditation when I was 21. Mm-hmm. I was studying philosophy, and I had the chance to be that one of my teachers was Francisco Varela, who was an important neuroscientist who tried to understand meditation as a way to understand the mind. And he was the man who really created the whole idea of Man and Life Institute with the Dalai Lama. And so I was introduced into meditation by him in a very solid and profound way. He was very in love with meditation. And after, through him, I get into Tibetan Buddhism to understand meditation and study with different teachers. And 17 years ago, I saw that we need to try to give transmission of meditation not only inside of Buddhism, but in more broad way, more broad. And
And you consider your school to be like secular rather than religious, or is that a bad way of putting it?
The problem I had, that I found that it's difficult to really see it from outside. But 17 years ago, there was very few meditation in many Buddhist centers. Mm-hmm. Some people think that you have meditation inside of the religious, and when you put it outside, you make meditation lighter, more simple for people who don't have the courage to engage into Buddhism. But that was not at all my experience. I was very, I saw that there was few, and we talked a lot about that with Francisco, who was very disappointed himself by the fact that in Buddhist people get into a religious idea of devotion and believing in the guru and many things that didn't allow them to go really into the profundity of meditation.
Yeah, and perhaps we can say the opposite is true, that it's much, much harder to practice meditation in the middle of Paris or in your busy life. And
For me, the decision was to try to be faithful to the artisans of meditation that I found that was where the problem. And that was one of things. So I thought we have to go into presenting meditation in a larger way. But also, the situation came because I thought that there was, particularly in the school that I knew of Tibetan Buddhism and in other school, a lot of corruption. I was a very I was in great pain to see so much corruption, power manipulation of sex and money, not telling the truth, fight of power, and I found I something was not true, and it was a time of great pain for me. So at this time, I had the idea to open meditation in a larger way, to go into, I still presenting and we still studying Buddhism, but not in a religious way, but we go back to the text, we go back to Tibetan, Chinese, Sanskrit, and we question the text. We try to be more, like we call in West, hermeneutic. We try to have to not take the text as something fixed, but more something that asks to be read and interpret in relation to all the text, to all the knowledge.
Yeah, and I forgot to mention, Fabrice, that you're a philosopher as well, and you studied a lot of philosophy, and perhaps that informs your Western philosophy, and perhaps that I'm sure that informs how you look at Buddhist texts and reinterpret them. And
yes, because as Westerners, I studied Western philosophy very intensively. I did a PhD in La Sorbonne, but in a more deep way. I found that is very strange when you are Westerners to go into, by example, Buddhism and just forget about the knowledge of the West. Mm. One. Two, I was more and more struck by the fact that many people talk about Buddhism, but in fact, when you know Western philosophy, you realize they just talk about Western philosophy without knowing it. By example, many people think they talk about Buddhism. They're just talking about a kind of stoicism.
Right.
And Epicure.
I don't know. Epicureanism. Yeah, I remember you saying that before, that a lot of the Buddhism in the West is a kind of Epicureanism and Stoicism.
Yes.
Using Buddhist sort of terminology, but they haven't really got to the depth of the tradition. But,
by example, everybody talks that Buddhist now is impermanence. You say that impermanence?
Impermanence, yeah.
So that is almost the basic level that everybody agree. Hmm. But honestly, it's so simple to believe the idea of impermanence is so general. Particularly Buddhist. And impermanence is a definition of the nature of reality. You make a statement about reality to be impermanence. That not at all the point of view of Buddhism, who never is a metaphysic, who try to say what is reality. Buddhism is more a kind of practice, and the knowledge of Buddhism is more a way to help you to see more clearly your own relation to reality.
Right.
They not have this kind of objectivity. Hmm. Is much
so the
more
Buddhist, can I just try to understand Buddhist? What you mean is like the idea of impermanence or something like that is not some kind of description of reality. It's one sort of thing to work with, a process of try to understand.
It's a process, is a way to change your mind. But we make Buddhism like a description of reality, which is very weak. Hmm. So you have all these people who say, Heraclitus said, we never go two times in the same river. And that is like Buddha. And we make this link, which is extremely weak, because Heraclitus was not saying at all that. It was much, much more deeper. Mm. And we make things so weak, and we try, and we think we know about Buddhism. We're just projecting on Buddhism a distorted view that we can have a kind of objective grasp on reality. And through impermanence, I have a better grasp on reality, which is And many, many things like that. And we're not going into detail, but it will be very interesting to see that why many people have the idea that on Buddhism is just stoicism, it's just the whole idea of ataraxy. So that means you are calmed down, you are relaxed, which has nothing to do with Buddhism.
Yeah. I noticed this actually, like during the COVID crisis, that a lot of people are doing meditation courses online, and it's always about calming down dealing with stress and dealing with your troubles like this. And I think what you're trying to say is that there's an adventure to meditation and a rigor, and that it's not some kind of, tranquilizer that you take to calm your mind.
Yes. So the first point was Buddhism in the West, unfortunately, over the year, had become more, I've lost the life that was in Buddhism when they come in the West in the 70s, 80s, around later on. First, you have a generation of people who was in retreat in Tibet for 20 years, 30 years, who came to the West. There was something so deep, so real in them that really touched people. But the new generation people get more interested in power and manipulation. And I thought we need to open meditation to everyone. That was the first step. The second step happened 10 years ago, 7 years ago. I realized that meditation, I realized that I was facing a new problem. Meditation become, like we just talked before, a way to tranquilize yourself, to just calm down, to just have a better,
To manage stress, right?
Manage stress. Yeah. And I thought that is a big problem, because that is just manage stress. It's just the whole idea of neoliberalism, who try to make people work under the die.
Manage everything too. Manage
manage everything.
And your love life, your stress, it's a kind of control, and then meditation just becomes another one of those those things, another product.
And one thing is not effective. It doesn't work. More you say to people, manage your stress, worst they are, because nobody can do it. More you say manage your stress, worse you are, because everyone is have stress, everybody had anxiety, pain, and that is part of human life. And the idea of managing, you should manage your bank account, but you can't manage your own heart, your own living. And the fact that we're using economic image about everything just is part of the problem. So when meditation is there for managing your stress, it's just creating more problems that help. And I found that was a big problem. That was a big problem because I saw that people trying to doing that, by doing that, they were losing their own heart. They feel guilty because they never succeed. They feel guilty to feel pain, fear, anxiety. They feel like something is wrong with them. And they want, through meditation, become someone else.
Yeah.
And the whole idea to understand meditation as you have to calm down, I find that is extremely aggressive. I was very struck by that, because
I was going to say that at a meditation retreat, for example, you experience all kinds of pain and suffering, and it's hard and challenging, and
yes,
it's nothing really. If you go to a Zen, sesshin, for example, this has nothing to do with being calm. It's about getting to the nature of reality, getting to the depths of of things.
Yes. You know? So I find that the whole approach of meditation to get to manage your stress just avoid people to do what meditation is about, contacting your own heart, your own pain, transforming, making more in peace. And I really make a distinction between calm and peace. Mm-hmm. When the sea is calm, the boat can't move. Mm. Peace, you can be in peace and having pain. You can be in peace and be anxious about the future of our world. But the idea of calm is like you enter into your own little bubble. Mm-hmm. A pink bubble or purple bubble, and you are in your own little things, and you are in peace, and you are calm. And I find that is a big problem. So that was for me a big difficulty. I was teaching meditation, and I realized that people don't get it. Mm-hmm. People, I was giving a seminar, and I remember, and people were having the feeling they don't succeed to doing it. They all have the feeling, I can't arrive to do meditation. And I realized that they all trust that by doing meditation, you should be calm. You should have no thought. You should are, and they have make a list of things that for them, what meditation should be, mm-hmm. and they feel guilty that they don't arrive to go into this approach. Mm-hmm. And I realize that we have to find another way. And in French is where I start to say, foutez-vous la paix. And unfortunately, it's very difficult to translate into English.
No, I think that's a wonderful translation, the French art of not giving a fuck. It's maybe too poppy, but it's not
as good as foutez-vous la paix, because foutez-vous la paix, first there is the word peace.
Yeah.
And foutez-vous is really give yourself peace by just stop. Mm-hmm. Torturing yourself.
I see.
And so I make, I start to talk about the, I try to start to talk to meditation through this approach. And there was two things by doing that. One thing is I try to cut the neoliberalism that is destroying our human relation to ourselves, to others, to nature, to the mm-hmm. earth. But I also, in this way, try to go back into a more deep relation to meditation that you have in Tibetan Buddhism, in Mahamudra or Dzogchen, mm-hmm. by the fact that you completely relax into the true nature of reality. You just stop to try to improve yourself, mm. but you have a glimpse of space. Of open space, but that you could find in other spiritual religions. You have that in Hasidic movement, in Judaism. Mm. You have that in Christianity. I was very interested in all the texts of the French 17th centuries of Christian texts, because there was a time of flourishing kind of meditation, mm. and you are just giving in. And just relax into the pure nature of love that is in yourself. So many interesting. So I find that without having to go into these texts in detail that make people are sometimes afraid of this approach, because by this approach of not giving a fuck, you go back to something more deep. Into mm-hmm. the level of meditation. Mm-hmm. And the book had a very strong impact in France. Mm-hmm. It was one of the books who sell the most the year I published it, 5 or 6 years ago. I was in the top 10 books who sell in the year. So
can I tell you why the title speaks to me? Because, well, I'm an English person living in France, and there's something about Anglo-Saxon mentality that gets very hyper-psychological about everything. And there's also this, as you say, this kind of marketing approach to life. So one of the things I love about being here is something about the French spirit that has that quality of not giving a fuck, if that makes any sense.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So the book had a very strong impact, and because people are suffering a lot by this approach of having to manage themselves, you know, you find in many places, people are doing burnout, they are overstressed, and the only message they have that is your fault. You should manage yourself better. And I try to show that is not true. Is people are they just suffer from a very hard approach of life, mm-hmm. destroying them from
and very hard on themselves.
Because they are on themselves, they don't like people don't like themselves because they have integrated this this social vision that we never do enough. Mm. Could say the mantra of our time is you don't do enough. Mm. You listen to me, but have you done enough? No. And that creates a doubt. No, yes, that's true. And you should do more. Mm. And being means doing more, being more efficient. And that is very poison that really destroy ourselves. And mm-hmm. I find it's important because there is a tendency that when we talk about meditation, spirituality, and so on, we have a tendency to think that everything is in your own mind. But that is really weak because there is also a violence in our times. And it's very important to be able to name it. Mm. To name what is the problem of our time.
Mm, the violence of our time, yeah.
And I must say that my great inspiration in all that was Shogam Trungpa Rinpoche, who really is a very great source of influence. And because Trungpa Rinpoche was, I think, the only Tibetan Buddhist teacher who really tried to understand the singularity of our time. Mm-hmm. And he was talking in many different ways, but one way was he said we live in the times of what he called the setting sun mentality, that is opposed to the Great Eastern Sun mentality. Mm. And we have some link with Nietzsche, because this whole idea that we prefer going to sleep, that this the morning when you have to wake up and to say yes to mm. the difficulty of life. And the setting sun mentality for him was destroying Earth by just trying to be more comfortable. Mm. And the way to willing to be more comfortable for him was really like a poison that destroying. And what he calls the setting sun mentality, you could say, is a mentality of, in a niche where you could say nihilism.
Nihilism, yeah.
You could say also is the mentality of trying to go to find comfort in every situation. Mm. And for him, meditation was not trying to find comfort, but to be more
right
awake, to be more curious, to be more sharp about what is reality. Yeah. And for me, even if I don't necessarily use the same word, I find that a great inspiration that we have to think historically what creates a particular time to understand more in which way meditation could be relevant to our time. Mm-hmm. When you think about the Buddha, one of the first things that the Buddha did when he started to teach meditation, he started to have a very strong analyze of the society where he was living in. He started to say, the whole structure of our society mm-hmm. is wrong, because the whole idea of
caste system
yes mm-hmm. is wrong, and separation between man and woman, and women can have no possibility to go into the spiritual world, is wrong. So it's very strange that we make now an image of Buddha of someone who is pure and read the world. And when you see his life, he was very engaged into analyzing what prevent life to flourish. And I think, what prevent life to flourish today? That's, from a point of view of meditation, I think that's the key point. And what prevent life is this idea that we have to be to manage everything, to be calm, to be and all that is based on kind of hatred toward life. We are all this teacher of meditation now, all this application of meditation, they just are based on kind of hatred toward life.
Yeah.
The contrary of hatred toward life is
and
life.
And if we're talking about Chogram Trungpa, and I also extremely inspired by him, I think that for me he was the most authentic teacher, you know, in the West, and his example was always just the most alive situation, right?
Yes.
Not some kind of escape from reality.
Yes. He was he was able to go into the negativity of the world to try to transmute the negativity, and he was not a kind of naive light love looking, which is so powerless.
And he was a tantric teacher, and it seems like today a tantric teacher is something that it can't be a public thing because it's too alive, and because we want to make everything a product, and we want to define everything, and we want to make everything safe and pure
and dead.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
There is a lack of love.
There's a lack of love.
You know. You could say the very key point is we are destroying all the link between meditation and love. I think there is many, Trungpa has many different sides. One side is how he was into understanding the historical singularity of our time, and of particularly nihilism from our times. Every time I have his own close, where to be close. Our time is not worse than any other times, but every time I have a different way to be close. Like in other times, religion become with Inquisition.
You said this before. You said every time has its denial of love. I think that's what you said. I remember you saying. And our denial of love is, how would you characterize that?
Because if you go back in some centuries, the close, the way that the time is closed, by example, by religious hatred. You have to belong to one religion, otherwise we have to kill yourself. You were killed. There was battle between religions. There was Inquisition. Inquisition who burned witches, who burn people who think differently. But our time is closed by this way of willing everybody to be happy. Happy in a very narrow way. Like just you have to have your own capital. Capital, you say capital?
Capital, no.
Capital. You have your capital health, your capital happiness, your capital, and you have
maybe resource is another is a word you could use.
But capital is better because it show that your own relation to yourself is like a relation to a capital. And people, even people who talk about the disaster of a kind of capitalism who don't respect anything, don't respect poor people, don't respect people in a poor country, don't respect nature, don't see that we have integrated the same way of looking ourselves. We're doing the same thing, and it's really lack of love. Mm-hmm. Lack of love, lack of being able to be open to reality as it is, to help reality to be more, to flourish, to be more kind.
Mm. You have a provocative book called Becoming Narcissistic. Is that the name of the book? I wanted to bring that up because I also thought that because almost everybody, one of the biggest insults you could call somebody today, and it's the diagnosis of the culture, right? Is that everybody is becoming narcissistic. Yes. And you're reinterpreting the myth of Narcissus, and I think this is beautiful as something else. So maybe you could.
Yes. So first, I will say I'm not reinterpreting the myth. I'm just telling what the myth is about. Because just to be sure, narcissic is the name of a flower. You have the same flower in English, narcissus.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
So. Narcissus is the name of a flower. It's the name of the first flower of spring. In spring, you have a thousand of narcissus who is the first flower. Is the flower sometimes is white with a heart yellow, sometimes it's only yellow, and you have different kinds. And I was wondering why there will be a myth of a man who is so full of himself, so egocentric, so full of ego, that they name him by the name of a flower. It makes no sense. Mm-hmm. So I try to go back to the myth and try to understand. And I realize that the myth is not about be completely full of yourself, but just be in contact with yourself and recognizing yourself. And the whole historical stories of the myth is Narcissus didn't recognize himself in the water, didn't know who he was, and he was lost. He was able to love other people. He didn't know how to love himself. He was cut from his family. He was in pain. And through recognizing his true nature, through recognizing who he was, he becomes like the flower, like the eclosion of life. Mm. That's what the myth.
So when he falls into the water, he falls into to everything or something
yes.
like that.
Yes. Mm. And is why the book one place when you find these stories is metamorphosis because it becomes a metamorphose into the flower. But that one point. The second point is everybody try to say that we live a time when people are very narcissistic. And I find we live in a time when people have very, very hard times to just become who they are. They are so into pressure. I was just starting to realize that with repeating something, and I just see the contrary. I don't see around me people who are full of themselves. I find a lot of people who don't arrive to think by themselves, to feel what they feel, to be in contact with their own heart. And I find it's very strange that what we're saying is exactly the contrary. We live in a time when people don't have space, don't have time, don't have resources to be in contact with the profundity of their own life. So I find, no, we're not in a time of narcissistic. We have a time when people have really deeply cut from their own inner life. And that was really for me.
That's the hatred you were talking about.
Yes, we don't arrive to like to be a deep love relation to ourselves because we are cut to our profound life. So people say to me, but no, you can't say that. People like Trump are completely narcissistic, and I say no. Trump is not narcissistic. Trump don't like himself because if he was really having a deep, profound, loving relation to himself, he will be not denying reality and trying to prove that always that he's right. When you are in love with yourself, you don't have to make so much effort that convince.
You don't have to put your picture on Instagram every 5 minutes to convince everybody how beautiful you are.
Yes, that because because it is exactly the opposite of narcissistic. Is a full of, how you say, orgueil in English?
Orgueil? Pride.
Pride. And when and pride, what is pride? Pride is willing to be someone you are not. You're so afraid of who you are, you have to create an image of what you want to be. So I find it very strange that we mixed loving yourself by the fact that being pride of creating an image because you don't love yourself. I just thought that is very basic psychology. And I find meditation is a way to be able to recognize something, a gift that is in yourself, a gold that is in your own heart, and that is narcissistic. And philosophy is about, you can think by yourself. You could say, what the beginning of philosophy in the West with Socrates is, Socrates arrived everywhere, talked to people and said, what you think is important, even if you are nobody, I don't care. What do you think? That is what philosophy was in the West. And that is narcissistic because everybody has the ability to think by themselves. So I was trying to think another approach of meditation that is very, I find meditation, the approach of meditation is so weak, so naive, so full of, it's very weak. It's no trust, no love, no vision. That is really, that bothered me.
At the end of the beginning of the century, there were all of these kind of schools. There were all these kind of schools in Sweden and in Northern Europe that sprung up, and they were kind of, you know, schools where you would train in philosophy, you would train in meditation, you would train in all these different kinds of things, rather than just doing one thing. And I think you're kind of doing the same thing. Your school is very, you have a lot of, there's a lot of elements to it. There's a lot of different things, so that meditation doesn't become just this little technique that you do to relax in the morning. There's a whole holistic, I don't know if that's the right word, but process of learning going on, right?
Yes. So maybe first thing, if I can correct what you said, the school of meditation is not just in Paris. We are in every place. Francophone world, because we are in Montreal, we are in Bruxelles, we are in Geneva, we are in many other places in Switzerland and in many places in France. So we are a Francophone organization. And we do things in residential. We do things also by internet, we have class, many different things. So it's true that meditation, my conviction is meditation could be like the forces who open to everything for new renaissance. Like the renaissance, they found back some Greek inspiration to new approach to everything. I find meditation is a key to help us to have another approach to politics, to economics, to philosophy, to art. Why?
Psychology, to the whole everything. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Why? Because in our time, we are cut from experience. We go into concept. Like we do this interview in the middle of the COVID crisis, and we are confined in our home, and everybody realized how difficult it is just to know what we feel, to be in contact with what we experiment. We are, even if we are at home all day long, it's very difficult to cut from information that don't tell us very much, and to go into a deeper feeling that gave us strength and be aware to
Oh, I remember the word I was looking for, Bildung. It was called Bildung. It was a German word, and it was something about becoming a person. Yes. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And so true meditation, that changed completely the relation we have with art. Because art is not just something we have to understand, something for few people, but it's an experience. So, by example, one thing I do often is I do meditation in middle of concert. I did that in Opéra Bastille, in the great opera at Bastille last October. Someone play music. I do an exercise of meditation. She plays the same piece, and we ask people what they experience, and they are completely surprised and shocked that just by doing 5 minutes of meditation, they hear music like they never heard. Because in our times, people don't get trained
to listen, to feel.
We are very into concept, very abstract, and very difficult for us to learn what means the sensibility. You know, when you go at school from all years, never you have class when you learn how to go into the, how to go deeper into what means feeling. So meditation, so we do many things about art in our school of meditation.
Yeah, and that's what I wanted. I mean, that's what I think is so unique about your school.
We can go to museum and meditation with painting to have another relation to painting. We could have that with music. And we could have that. So we have class sometimes with many different things. We had a class on Beethoven lately, and we were trying to go deeper into Beethoven. I must say that in philosophy, I was very much marked by phenomenology. I find that there is a lot of link between phenomenology and meditation. Phenomenology was this idea that start at the beginning of the 20th century to maybe not make philosophy a way to elaborate concepts, but more into describing experience, describing the relation you have to phenomena. So what do you see, what do you feel when you listen to music, when you meet someone, when you have a thought, when you have imagination, going more into describing. And there is a lot of link between meditation and phenomenology. So that was one of the key.
And but the other thing you teach is poetry too, right? I know that you've taught me a few things about modern poetry, and why do you think that's so important? And why is it so absent from, you know, I think that's another reason why I think what you're doing is so important is I think that people have this sort of very anti-poetic spirit today. Because poetry is so important.
Our relation to poetry, to music, to art is cultural, aesthetic. First is cultural. That means you have to have culture. I have no interest into culture. I'm not reading poetry to have culture. I read poetry to go into a deeper relation to my own life and to the world. And I don't know any great poet who write poetry as a fact of culture. A poet since the oldest time is a relation to truth. The poetry came in the West. To understand poetry, we have to go back into the mythology as a way to describing what is poetry. And the myth of poetry is Orpheus. And Orpheus which is the first poet. Then the mythology of the Greek mythology said Orpheus is the first poet. Orpheus go into, how you say, enfer, les enfers.
Into hell, into the underworld.
Into the
Hades underworld. Or,
By love, because Eurydice, the woman he loved, was killed by a snake. Go look after her and go into the underworld. And that is all the idea of poetry. By love, you go on on the underworld to bring back a light. We will be a true light, not the light of avoiding reality, but the light that go through touching reality. That is poetry for the West. Poetry for the West has always been sought as a way to go into the pain and the difficulty to bring back light.
Yeah. You say the West, is that like, I guess that's different from, let's say, haiku poems or poems, yes, but, poems of the East, or is it the same thing? Or is it like a universal thing, or is it just,
I say
the West?
You don't. I think that that particularly how the West call it poetry, and I find that very interesting for us, that poetry, because what I want to try to show is a lot of people have no link to poetry, painting, because they think it's cultural, and they are intimidated
because it's supposed to be high culture of some kind.
Yes, they're afraid it's not for them, and they don't see that artists are exactly like them. The cultural world is not like them.
Because it's tried to make it special.
People are not like them, but the artists are exactly like them. The people who live in the middle of the world and trying to bring back some light, some kind of love, like everybody. So that's the first problem. And the second problem, art is in relation to aesthetic. And aesthetic means I feel something pleasant. But art is not to do with aesthetic. I don't go to listen music to feeling, oh, I feel something so good. Oh, it's so... No.
No, yeah.
Art is about truth. It's not about just having some kind of pleasure. It's about some kind of truth you feel when you listen.
Or maybe as what would you say? Meaning. It has. It's meaningful.
Meaningful when you listen.
Which is beyond the beyond just pleasure or
yes,
or just an experience.
Yes, when I listen Beethoven, what I did lately, I not just having some nice experience. I find his music show me another, open my eyes to another dimension of reality that I lost. It's like that the world become more real.
Yeah.
And so when you understand that, your relation to the world change in a very deep way.
Yeah. And one of the things I've heard you say is like searching for happiness is a really stupid, another stupid idea of our culture. This search for happiness that
I would say we have to make careful about what we call happiness, because happiness, the wonderful word, is the art of the teaching of Aristotle. But happiness, if it becomes just kind of comfort, kind of how you call that, bien-être. In English.
Yeah, bien-être is a very French phrase. Well-being. Well-being is the...
Well-being.
Yeah.
There is a big distinction between well-being and real happiness. Happiness is not just well-being. Happiness, if happiness is... Because in Aristotle's happiness, the question of happiness is a question of in which way I accomplish my life is deepest and more profound sense.
Yeah.
Who's asking me what makes me happy? I ask the most ethical question for my life. Does that make sense? But having an idea that happiness is just well-being, and I don't want to be in contact with pain, suffering, anxiety, that just makes me more and more weak.
Exactly, yeah. So there's a more profound kind of happiness, which includes, you know, all of the vicissitudes of life, you know, pleasure, pain, everything. So one of the questions I had for you is you know, there seems to be something wrong, right, these days with Western Buddhism. It just seems all wrong to me. It seems like most of it is all wrong. I don't want to insult anybody or for a lot of the reasons that you're saying. So to the point where, you know, what is the importance of Buddhism in the West, right? I mean, why is Buddhism important?
I don't know if it's important anymore. What I discovered in Buddhism that was very profound when I was 30 years ago, I don't know if people can have this contact now.
Yeah, I don't know either. Maybe they do in some places, but...
But at the same time, you know, it's true for everything. How we have a relation with Buddhism, how we have a relation with Christianity, how we have a relation with Judaism, how we have a relation to poetry, how we have a relation to music, how we have a relation to Earth, is a big question for everyone.
So the question is just how do you have a relation, basically?
Yes,
basically.
How do you have a relation which is more honest, mm-hmm. which is not based on fear? And Buddhism is wonderful. Christianity had extraordinary, profound resources, richness. But poetry is the same thing, you know. Music, the same thing. But sometimes I go to a concert, and I see that for many people, it's just a distraction. They don't go to live the same experience that I try to live there. And it's part of life, you know.
Yeah. Listening to Beethoven or something like that, your experience of that is more meaningful in a Buddhistic sense than, you know, saying a bunch of mantras and wearing some Tibetan clothing and costumes and trying to adopt a mentality.
Yes, and it's very interesting. That was the idea of Trungpa Rinpoche, you know, when he tried to talk about the whole idea of warriorship. He tried to create another context that would be broader than just Buddhism.
Yeah.
He had this vision. But I just find Buddhism is a very profound, extraordinary tradition, and I'm still doing some practice that come from the Tibetan tradition. I still studying text, sometimes some very difficult text, and with great joy. I just find that the transmission of Buddhism become really weak because there is a lack of depth, and the depth is also have to go through questioning the text, having a relation to Western philosophy, not using a word that, you know, a lot of the Buddhist texts use a kind of terminology that really is not appropriate. I just talk about impermanent, but I could talk about cause. They use the word cause, but cause in the Western world have nothing to do with cause in
so Buddhism. Often it's a question of translation. Well, it's very interesting to also look at you know, I find myself reading Meister Eckhart and things like this because a lot of the stuff is just doesn't touch me because it's too Tibetan or it's too foreign. So I find myself I need to study my own culture.
Yes.
But that makes the Buddhist practice, you know, that we both engage in, you know, more alive, right? If we're studying.
Because the problem is not that Tibetan is foreign. The problem is the way we translate Tibetan Buddhist make it dead.
Yeah.
And the translation is not just, is more deep question that we thought, because you could say that the way the Roman translate Greek philosophy have created the whole Roman approach. In the Renaissance, the way they translate Greek create another culture. And the way in the 19th century we try to translate a new way, create a new culture. And you could say in the 20th century, some philosopher try to, like Kierkegaard, Nietzsche, Heidegger, try to go back to the Greek and make a new translation, create a new approach. So
that's what you're doing. That's what your mission is, in a way. It's just translation. Yeah.
Translation is not just translation. It's not that you put your text, put it on Google Translation, and having Translation is how you read things. You know, when people have decided that meditation will be called mindfulness, that was translation that creates a lot of decision. It's a very deep decision. And maybe that was a great mistake to call meditation mindfulness.
Oh, yeah. Talk about that. Yeah, talk about that. That's interesting. Yeah.
But why? Mindfulness is just mind. Mm-hmm. And maybe meditation is not about so much about mind. Maybe meditation is about body. Mm. Meditation is about heart. Maybe meditation should have been called heartfulness.
Because maybe the word originally was mind, heart, or something like that, or, you know, in Tibetan, or maybe...
No, in Tibet, meditation have nothing to do with mindfulness. Meditation is a different...
Familiarization word. Or something like that is a word that people use sometimes. Being familiar with your... Being intimate with yourself.
Yes, yeah. With familiar. So, mindfulness is not... is not bad, but it's just by doing this translation, you have created an understanding of meditation that you could question. Awareness could have been another approach, which personally I find more profound.
Awareness is more profound than mindfulness.
The awareness, I know how you pronounce, but EWWE. Have so much resonance, and is a word that you find in American poetry, and and awareness is I find that is amazing, all the resonance of awareness. It will have been very interesting to call meditation awareness, awareness practice. It would be completely different to mindfulness practice.
Awareness practice. Yeah.
And that is just one example. We could take 100, but you just see that by doing a choice of one translation, you have an interpretation that could really close something.
Yeah. Well, it seems like also the history of Buddhism in the West is very young. So certain terms, certain ideas stick, and then other ones, don't. And
no, I think I will say. The problem is not that it's so much so few time, because I think we were much more open 20 or 30 years ago. The point is we're translating Buddhism and meditation to put it in the box of the whole idea of management. And there is a mindfulness go more fit more into the box of management that awareness. Because you can't go to business world and say to people, you have to work more, do some mindfulness to be more efficient. You can't say to people, you do heartfulness or awareness to be more efficient. So it will not work. So you see that.
So this is a term that can be easily manipulated to.
That is why it was translated this way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And by translating this way, people understand, and some people, but at the same time, we lose something. We lose something of the extraordinary power of the situation.
Mm-hmm. Have you been thinking about how the world's going to be different after this pandemic, and what's happening now, and what's going on? Is it almost not too early to talk about that sort of thing?
I don't know. Yeah. And I'm very surprised all these people who think they know.
People know so many things. Yeah.
I feel as engaged into meditation, I think the question is, what do we live in this situation? I think it's not so easy to understand what is happening to us. I find before trying to know what will happen in the future, it would be good to know what is happening in the present. And I find it's very difficult to understand what is happening now. Mm-hmm. And as a philosopher, I know that philosophy is not about just make commentary of actuality
on
news. But philosophy take a time to see what beyond what you see, what is right. More profound. And I think it is.
Because we could make a lot of vulgar pronouncements about reality. And, yes. And
so I'm working on that very intensively. I'm working to try to be at the level of what is happening mm-hmm. in terms of my meditation and in terms of philosophy.
Yeah.
But I think it's more work. How you be at the level of the situation. But we miss a lot of knowledge that we're going to have soon in the future, but mm-hmm. be able to understand more clearly. But I will say, and maybe we can close our discussion on that. But at the same time, meditation helped me to be in kind of insecurity and mm-hmm. not to be afraid of insecurity.
Yeah.
By accepting insecurity, we can go beyond crisis. The mm-hmm. philosopher Hannah Arendt said, in a crisis, the main important thing is to not repeating to do what you already know, but to arrive to let go your preconception about reality.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful,
that's,
yeah.
That's really important because what we know is not going to work. We have to create a new way. And mm-hmm. by creating new ways, it's not so easy. You have to accept uncertainty. In this way, meditation is very helpful. And I'm not, by example, I gave a lecture to people who direct important business. Mm-hmm. I'm not against talking to people about business. I'm not just talking about management. We had a lot of exchange and some guide meditation, and it was a lot of them was to how to be in contact with what we feel, how to be in contact with uncertainty, and not being afraid of our fear, because it's through this kind of fear that we find the strength to face the situation. Mm-hmm. And so that's really one of the key points. And the second point is how to having some hope. Mm-hmm. I find in the time of intense suffering, could we find hope? Mm-hmm. And not hope as a project for future reality. Is what not interesting that to have plan, because I think like what Bergson, the French philosopher of the beginning of the 20th century, Bergson will said, the future is not existing in the present. But the time is the creation of new reality all the time. So mm-hmm. nobody will know the pandemic will have this effect. We don't know what will happen. And it's better to be open to possibilities that exist than to just try to put reality in our box. Mm-hmm. And so that's the second point is having this openness and hope. So it's not a
project. I like that instead of hope being, trying to create some kind of utopia, better world in the future. Hope is a kind of openness towards reality that, life can be beautiful.
I like very much to understand hope to go into Kant. Some people ask Kant, what will be the future? Does there will be a good future or a bad future? And Kant said, we can't know. Because no man could have a relation to all or everything that happens in a completely objective way, because we are part of reality. We can't mm-hmm. be outside of reality. So he said, nobody can know if the future will be good or bad, better or worse. But one thing, as human beings, we all have the desire, the aspiration that the future will be better. Mm-hmm. That some more peaceful and more loving world will be. So I find hope is a way to lessen our own aspiration that something will come from this situation that will be helpful. Mm-hmm. And this aspiration is not in the future. Hope is in reality. And mm-hmm. by contacting this hope, I feel more trust and confidence And I have more confidence to see how I can help the world. I'm not just, when I have a utopia, I'm waiting that other people doing things, and I get pissed off when things don't happen the way I want. Mm-hmm. When I go into this understanding of hope that I'm talking, this aspiration link in our inner life, mm-hmm. I that overcome my depression, that overcome my discouragement. I feel more trust, more confidence, more strength that I can help in my own way. And I think that is more important. And the third thing, so how to work with crisis, mm-hmm. and not afraid of uncertainty, to finding hope in a new way, like aspiration. And the third way is we are free in a painful way, in one sense. But we feel sometimes in this situation that we are not free, that we are completely trapped by the reality. And I think it's interesting to what I learned from philosophy, the 20th century's philosophy, is we are put in the world. We have no choice. We have to decide.
We are thrown in the world. Are you referring to Heidegger? Or
Heidegger, yeah, or Sartre. Yeah. Or, yeah. Sartre talk a lot about freedom, that we have no choice. We are free because we have no choice to make something of the situation. Mm. And I find it's very interesting to I'm not free because I can do whatever I want. I'm free because I have no other choice to respond to the reality.
Ah, that's great.
I'm not free. It's just what Sartre called mauvaise foi. How you say mauvaise foi?
Bad faith. Bad faith.
But you said that, but
yeah,
but
you can say bad faith in English. You can say that. Yep.
It's a lie. Mm-hmm. It's a lie. You try to pretend that you can't do, you're not free because of the situation, but we are free to do something, to change our view, and to make choice. And that is why what meditation helped me to be in contact with, not afraid of uncertainty, and finding way to overcome crisis. Hope as finding our inner inspiration and knowing that whatever I do, I have to make choice, and this choice is.
And that's what Viktor Frankl discovered, right? When he was in the concentration camp.
Yes, and so
freedom to make a choice.
If you understand what I'm saying about crisis, about hope and about freedom, you see that these three, to be in contact with them, you have to accept some kind of difficulties, uncertainty. Mm-hmm. It's not so easy, but it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And that is why I'm trying to what I find helpful. Don't be afraid of your own imperfection, because that's the way you can have the strength to change the situation, your own situation and the situation in the world.
Mm. Beautiful. Thank you. Thank you very much, Fabrice. That was really, really great to talk to you, and great conversation. And I loved it. Thank you very much. I hope that other people from the English world can benefit from your teachings and your school, because I find myself agreeing with everything you say. I think it's so true what you're saying. So thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. Bye.